One of the issues that I skipped yesterday, I said I was going to talk about it, but I never got around to it. And this is this idea of sammata and vipassana and anapanasati. I said that anapanasati, I asked the question, is it vipassana practice? Is it sammata practice? What is it? We often hear, when if you've been a Buddhist for a while, you will know that there is often this distinction made between vipassana practice on the one hand and sammata practice on the other. Vipassana often translated as insight, sammata usually translated as calm or peace and tranquility. So two kind of different methods of meditation. And the question is, how does this relate to the practice we have been doing here, watching the breath and all these kind of things? What are these things? And the first thing, my personal feeling is that very often this division between vipassana and samatha is often, to me, very artificial. In reality, to me, that division is much less clear-cut than you might think. Yeah. And very often, they're just used as labels. My technique, I call it vipassana, right? My technique, I call it samatha. But they're more labels than often meaningful pointers to what is actually being necessarily done in that particular practice. So this is the kind of the first thing here. But there are... In the early suttas, rather, what you find is a different type of distinction. And the distinctions that you find in early suttas is about meditating on a particular object, right? Watching the breath, watching the feelings in the body, perhaps, meditating on a certain object, and another one, which is called the development of perception, which is like reflection about things. These are two categories you find in the suttas. And one is where you sit down and you meditate and you focus on something. And the other one is more a loose kind of reflection about the nature of reality. Right? So when you watch the breath, that would be called bhavana. It would be called meditation practice. Bhavana is one of the words used in the suttas. Whereas if you walk back and forth and you think about impermanence, right? You think about non-self, you reflect on this in a certain way, you try to take it on board, right? Or you reflect on death or whatever it is. That is called reflection, right? Or is it called a development of sanya? And these are really the two separate categories according to the suttas, the word of the Buddha himself. What is this all about? Now, first of all, vipassana, this particular word, often translated as insight. I think that a more suitable translation for this word is clear seeing things with clarity. Insight really means wisdom. It means kind of a more profound understanding of things. That happens further down the path. But clear seeing, I think, is a better translation of this word, vipassana. So how does all of this work? What is actually going on here? And what is going on is that these two ways the Buddha talks about, sitting down, watching the breath, and contemplating things, both of these methods of practice, right? One being reflection, one being calming down, they have the same purpose. And the purpose of both of these methods, at least initially, is to abandon the defilements of the mind. Right? So when you sit down and you watch the breath and you focus on the breath, you're not allowing desires, you're not allowing anger and negativity to arise in the mind. Because you're not allowing these things to arise in the mind, it means that your mind is more peaceful. It isn't being disturbed by all these defilements arising in the mind. So that's why when you keep on watching the breath and you allow everything to kind of fade in the background, especially when you start to see the beauty of the breath, the happiness, the joy in the breath, everything else in the world fades into the background, and the defilements gradually pass away, and you become more and more peaceful as a consequence. The defilements need to be nurtured. It's only when you think about the defilements that they become stronger. If you stop thinking about them, if you don't allow desire and aversion to arise, they gradually fade by themselves. That's the nature of these defilements. You have to feed them to keep them going. Only when you feed them are they kept going. This is straight from the suttas. The only way you're going to feel desire for something is if you focus on its beauty. If you focus on the breath, you're not feeding the defilements, they gradually die away. This is how that works, the idea of calming down, the defilements dying away. Now, if you do an exercise in developing your perceptions, if you reflect on impermanence, right, and you remember that everything in life is so, or so many things in life are so unstable, they are so unreliable, you can't control them. You don't know when things are going to, disappear. How long is your relationship going to last? How long are you going to have your job? How long are you going to live? All of these things are uncertain. And because they are uncertain, once you start to get a feeling for the impermanence, the unreliability of things, that too reduces the defilements. Because what it does, it releases some of the attachments and desires that you have for the things in the world, right? And because, again, the desires and attachments get reduced, this is precisely a reduction in defilements. So both the watching the breath and the reflecting on things in the right way both reduce the defilements in the mind. This is the whole purpose of the path, that is initially, to reduce the defilements for the mind to become as peaceful as you possibly can. Now, when the defilements in the mind are reduced in this way, two things happen. And the two things that happen as the defilements are reduced is you become more peaceful. So you use peace, in a sense, by watching the breath, or you watch the breath to reduce the defilements. The consequence of that is you feel more peaceful. It makes it even easier to watch the breath. So you watch it more, defilements go down more, you feel even more peaceful. It's like this snowball effect, right? So watching the breath is just a method for allowing the mind to become peaceful. Reduction in defilements make you feel more peaceful. Reduction in defilements also does something else. It gives you more clarity. You see things more in accordance with reality. Why? Because the defilements always distort the way we look at the world. When you are greedy for something, there's a vested interest in acquiring that object. If you're angry with somebody, there's a vested interest in being angry at them or seeing them in a negative light. There's a vested interest there. That means we're not able to see things objectively. When you reduce the defilements of the mind, you have more clarity. You see things more clearly, right? So this is how this whole process works. You focus on an object of meditation, or you reflect on something. Either of those methods reduce the defilements. When the defilements are reduced, two things happen as a consequence. Calm, clear seeing, samatha and vipassana. Both of those are outcomes of the reduction in defilements. And then both of those then enable the path to be taken even further. It's this snowball effect. So this is how this works. So what then is mindfulness of breathing when we do the Anapanasati practice? What is that? And what it is, because if you do the mindfulness of breathing in the right way, you get two results. You feel more calm and you see things more clearly. So from that point of view, it can be considered both a samatha practice and a vipassana practice. In fact, everything in Buddhism, if it's practiced in the right way, is both samatha and vipassana. If you sit down and you watch the feelings in the body, and that actually gets you somewhere, you feel get both vipassana and samatha as a consequence of that as well. So all of these things are heading you in the right direction. And this is the how I understand that this is actually explained in the suttas. And I personally don't like this distinction between samatha meditation, vipassana meditation. All meditation done in the right way, it leads to both samatha and vipassana, both calm and insight. It takes away some of all these divisions we have. We don't really need all of these divisions. If we can, I think what matters is that we're heading in the right way. And then things will develop as a consequence in the right way. That is when we're doing the right practice. So this is one of those very pragmatic things. Just notice for yourself, is it working for you? Is it giving some good results, right? That is the most important thing here. And if it stops working, somebody said to me, I've been meditating so much and now it's not really working so much anymore. Well, then you have to investigate, why isn't it working here? There is a reason for that. It doesn't stop working by itself. Sometimes it can be natural cycles, right? You go through natural cycles. But in the long run, there are reasons why these things happen. Okay, so I'm going to go through the last few questions here. Are there spiritual guides who help us in this life? Thank you. Yes, there are. The spiritual guide is called the Buddha. He is a spiritual guide. The spiritual guide is not some kind of airy-fairy thing out there which tells you, whispers in your ear, oh, do this, do that. The spiritual guide is the Buddha and all the other people who have practiced this path before you, right? They are your spiritual guides. So people like Ajahn Brahm teach, anyone who you take as your teacher is your spiritual guide. One of the things that is important in Buddhism is, I personally feel, is to have a grounding in the teachings of the Buddha, because the Buddha is the final authority on what is real Buddhism. You can listen to this teacher, you can listen to that teacher, they may say completely contradictory things, and you think, who am I going to listen to? And usually you listen to the person you like the most, right? Oh, I like Ajahn Brahm, he's my teacher, so I'm going to listen to him. Fair enough, you can't really, as far as I'm concerned, you're not going to go very far wrong with doing that. But in the end, really, the real authority is the Buddha, and that is where you should place your final confidence if you have to choose between people. Okay. When I meditate, I have lost awareness of my body. I came back with a jerk and the head of the head and realized that I had been dreaming, like watching a film. I may not identify what I was feeling. Is there more depth than what I have experienced, and how can I reach that depth? I may not identify what I was seeing. Okay. This is just a case of losing your mindfulness, right? You are lost in kind of fantasy land. You are dreaming away. You have no idea what's going on. It's just kind of running by itself. And this is exactly what lack of mindfulness is all about. At that point, if you're dreaming away, this is exactly not mindfulness. The moment you kind of, oh, where have I been? That's when you regain mindfulness. Mindfulness is actually knowing what's happening. It's having perspective on things. It's not being lost in dreams and fantasies. So what you want to do is just, okay, fine, you have been fantasizing. You know, that's life. People fantasize. Don't worry too much about it. And then you just come back to the present moment. And then you come back just to feeling the body and just allowing, you know, feeling peaceful and trying to bring up some positive perceptions. You come back to that again. And then suddenly you're off in fantasy land again, right? This is the way it goes, and gradually you overcome that, especially if you practice an integrated path with all the factors coming together here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I find long bushwalks very beneficial to my practice and was delighted when the new land was briefly available. Is there a chance that a walking track will be reopened, or are there other suggestions for longer bushwalks? Thank you for the teachings. Well, there are lots of possibilities for doing bushwalks. One of the best ways to do that is to go across the road. If you go up to Kingsbury Drive, the main road up here, go across the road, you can walk into the bush, and there's endless bushland in that direction. You can walk for hours, and you're not gonna, and you may end up getting lost, and we may have to send out a search party to find you. But apart from that, it's okay. You can, you are more than welcome to walk into the bush. It's very safe to walk in the bush here. All you see is a few animals and things. As far as the land over here is concerned, the idea is to build a hermitage on that side of the road, and that's why we have kind of, it's temporarily closed for meditators and jhana goers. You have too many people wandering around. It takes away from the seclusion of a hermitage. So that's why it is mostly closed off. But there are lots of other opportunities for walking around here. Also the bushland in which direction are we now? The bushland to the east of here. Which eastern direction? Oh, I'm a bit lost now. Roughly that way or something like that. It's also basically you can just walk, keep walking as far as you like. So there is lots of opportunities for that if you like that. And I agree with you. It's nice to be in nature, right? Nature calms you down. Makes you feel peaceful, and that's one of the reasons why we have the retreat center right here. Okay, next one. Was Jesus Christ an enlightened, recreated being? If so, all man has to do is believe that he is God. Then we can all go to heaven and not even bother about being good, which is so hard. Impossible to be good. Yes, maybe. Well, you know, that would be nice, wouldn't it? This is kind of the Christian idea. Oh, all you have to do is believe. If you kind of have faith that when you die at the end, then you can be saved from just through the power of faith and all these kind of things. And I, first of all, was Jesus Christ an enlightened being? I don't think so. It's very hard to really know exactly who Jesus Christ was. There is a little bit about him in the Bible. I haven't really read the Bible, to be honest. I was never a Christian. I didn't grow up in a family that was religious at all. So I kind of, for me, it was never really something. I have read a little bit here and there because it's kind of part of culture. You grow up in the West. The few things that Jesus said was, he said a few nice things, right? I mean, let's be fair. He said kind of, you know, it's when people ask for your shirt or something, you should give him. No, you give, people ask you for your jacket, give him your shirt as well or something like that. He said a few things that were actually very, very nice and very profound about kindness and about goodness in the world. And of course, that is great. That is good. These are excellent teachings. And any Christian who follows those teachings will reap the benefits of that. No doubt about it. But was he enlightened? I don't think there is any evidence at all to suggest that he was enlightened. Zero evidence, really. If anything, you know, if he believed in a creator God, I would say that is evidence he was not enlightened. That is precisely one of the indicators that you're not awakened if you believe in a creator God. This is one of the profound insights you have, the idea of non-self, is precisely to understand that isn't possible, really. So I would say no. It doesn't really help you. It's like believing in the Buddha, right? If I believe in the Buddha, because the Buddha was awakened from a Buddhist point of view, believing in the Buddha, is that enough to make you go to heaven? Can you be a real baddie, and do all kind of scallywag things and still go to heaven afterwards if you just have enough faith in the Buddha? And the answer is not really. It's about how you live your life that matters, right? So faith isn't really enough. Well, faith can kind of lift you up a little bit. It can have some good consequences to have confidence and faith in the right people. But it's really, in the end, it's your conduct that matters. So please don't fall for these kind of things. It is very dangerous, I think, to think these things. We all know in our hearts what really feels good. It feels good when you're kind. Trust that. Trust that feeling. Trust yourself. Don't go with ideas in your head that kind of seem nice, but actually, when you think about it for yourself, it doesn't really feel right. And I think this is why morality is really a natural thing for human beings, because it feels right to be moral. It feels right to do the right thing. We know it feels good. So it really, we go against our own better judgment when we do bad things. So trust some of that intuition that you have. Some of it is spot on. Okay, the universe is truly a marvelous creation, and humans are doing their best to ruin and destroy it. Humans don't like each other. How can we be happy? Is there really a purpose in this existence of mankind? this existential angst here. So, yes, human beings are doing their best to ruin and destroy it, usually because of ignorance, right? Because of stupidity, because of silliness, because not wanting to see, because of all of these kinds of things. I don't think anybody actually is really wanting to destroy the universe. I doubt it very much. I think people think that they're doing the right thing, but actually they're just misguided. That's what I think it really is mostly about. But remember, sometimes we are misguided too. Right? We have our own blocks, our own misunderstandings. It's very easy to focus on the misunderstandings and blocks of other people, but what about our own misunderstandings? And once you understand that this is part of the human condition, to have some misunderstanding and delusion, you don't judge other people so harshly anymore for their delusion, because you understand that you too are most likely deluded to some extent. And this feeling that you actually, knowing your own delusion, knowing your own limitations, is actually called wisdom in Buddhism to some degree. I think it's in the Dhammapada where it says the person who understands their own ignorance and delusion, they are at least wise to that extent. The person who doesn't understand, who thinks they're wise, well, they are really blind, right? So it's a good thing to have a bit of humility and understand your own limitations. Humans don't like each other. I don't know if that's true. I think humans usually like each other. I think it is very natural for us to have a sense of compassion for each other. I think, you know, we want to help other people in need. When we see somebody in trouble, as a natural, it gives rise to a natural sense of compassion, we wanting to help others. I think generally we do like each other. But often it is all kind of politics and all kind of problems that gets in the way. And these kind of, you know, these big things that kind of destroy, you know, you get indoctrination of people and politics that kind of destroy our natural feeling for compassion for other people. I think the vast majority of people do have compassion. I think they are kind. Sometimes these days we demonize the Muslim world and Islam and saying Islam is bad. But most Muslims are probably very good-hearted and kind people. They also want to be friendly. They just want to have a good life. They don't want to do bad things. Sure, there is a small minority that spoils everything for everybody else. But, you know, we have to be careful not to get into this idea that people are all bad. It isn't really like that. There is a lot of goodness and kindness in the world. So remember that. It's important. Don't take the news that you see on TV as reality. It's not reality. It's a digest of all the worst stuff that happens in the world put into half an hour. That's what it is, right? And if you take that as reality, well then, yes, then of course it looks very bad. It's not reality at all. Reality is more about your daily interactions with people. That's the real reality. Yeah. So learn to focus on things in the right way. Remember things in the right way. Learn to understand the limitations of other people. Have compassion when compassion is right. Have metta, have loving kindness when you see all the good actions happening around you. And then you get a nice balanced approach to these things. Is there really a purpose in the existence of mankind? Now, that is a very interesting question, right? Very profound. Is there a purpose to life? You know, why are we here? Is there really, what is this all about? And you really have to answer that question for yourself. But I would say, being a Buddhist, I would say, you know, we wander around, going from one life to the next one. Keep on going, doing the same thing over and over again, right? You've probably been sitting in meditation like this for hundreds of lifetimes before. You've been going through the same life, growing up, going through adolescence, having all the adolescent problems that people have, becoming a parent, having to deal with adolescence from the other side, right? Getting education, doing work, dying, wondering, what was this all about? I'm dying now. Gee, what was the point of all this? And then you move on to the next life, and you start from scratch again, doing exactly the same thing. You come to the end, and you think, what was the point of this one? And then after having done that a million times, asking yourself, what's the point? Then you know, and this is what the idea of recalling your past lives is all about. You start to see that, and it turns you away. You start to see that maybe there is no purpose to all of this. What am I doing this for? And of course that enhances your ability to practice your spiritual path. It leads to a sense of, don't want to do all that kind of stuff anymore. I'd rather just practice the spiritual life to get some real contentment and happiness inside myself. And then possibly also make an end of all this nonsense, really, right? That's what that's what it is from a Buddhist perspective. We're not doing anything. We're just going around and around, not actually going anywhere. In the new age, they have this idea of the age of Aquarius, right? Age, everybody's going to love each other, all this kind of stuff. And maybe sometimes we go through periods which are better and there is more love in the world. Then it goes down again, everybody, there's more hatred and negativity. Then it goes up again, and then in the end you think, okay, enough of all that going round and round. Anyway, that's my take on things. Maybe that sounds incredibly pessimistic and negative, right? But actually, there's a beautiful thing about that. We need to see things according to reality. And this is the way I regard reality. Only when you see things according to reality can you make good decisions in life. It doesn't make you miserable at all. Ajahn Brahm will tell you the same thing that I've been saying. And he's one of the happiest people that I have ever. He's a very, very happy person. So, you know, there's no contradiction here. It doesn't make you miserable. It's just about how you deal with these things. Yes.
And neuroscience, and it with his non-religious spirituality movement that he's done.
Yeah.
Anyway, there, and this young boy just comes up and says, you know, what was it like for lunch? And she looks at this funny guy who rides And all these neuroscientists are busting their ball, and they've been wanting to ask this question two or three years. And the Dalai Lama burst out laughing, and he said, "That's easy. The meaning of life is to be happy." The hard question is the second question: how do you be happy? For that, you have to study a little bit, know a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good story. Precisely, and that, you know, it is, and to discover what the meaning of life is, you just have to look inside of yourself. What do you want? And once you just understand what you really want, and you understand what the meaning of life is to get, basically to achieve what you really want, which is ultimately to be satisfied, to feel a sense of completion, feel a sense of, you know, of, yeah. So that's true. So, yeah, so that's the kind of an individual meaning of life for each one of us. Yeah. Okay, so two more questions, and then we have done all the questions for now. So, I want to be generous, and I have given money to those who ask and are in need. Sometimes it feels good, kind, and harmonious. Other times I can't help but feel I have been taken advantage of and used. Can I be kind and not be taken advantage of? Well, if you really feel that you are being taken advantage of, if you feel it is a dodgy situation, then don't give, right? If you feel that it is somebody is kind of scamming you or whatever, maybe in those kind of cases, don't give anything here. But remember also, it's good to give people the benefit of the doubt, right? Very often we are too cynical in this world and we think that people are not really worthy of these things. But very often people are actually worthy. And sometimes things are a bit mixed, right? The person is there may be a degree to which they are in need and a small degree perhaps to which they are taking advantage of you. But very often there is some degree to which there is a need there, something that needs to be met. So try not to be too cynical about things. Of course, if you go to India and you kind of, you know, you have all these kind of organized begging groups, etc., going after you and trying to kind of squeeze you dry for your last pennies or whatever, then of course, in those cases, I agree, it's good to be a little bit skeptical about those kind of people, right? It's just too dodgy what is going on sometimes. But try not to be too cynical and too skeptical, and try to do the right thing when you see that there is some need there. But if you really feel it is bad, you're taking advantage of, don't give, because then you are destroying the feeling of generosity, which should be a good feeling. It should be a positive thing. In that case, okay, today I won't do it. That is also okay. But try to shift your perception a little bit if you can. Okay, last question. I want to do what I can to make the world a better place. How can I still accept the world while trying to change it? Does my wanting to change it mean that I don't accept it? Okay, so one of the important points here about changing the world, remember that it can be very hard to change the world, right? It is very difficult. It is the world has been the way it is as far back as you can possibly go, and your influence is very limited. Sometimes we have too much hubris, we think we're going to change everything, but our ability as an individual is very limited. You know, look at the people around you, your friends, your family. How much power do you have to change the people around you? And even there, it is quite limited, right? Even there, you understand that people are conditioned through their own past, through their own history, whatever it is. And your ability to recondition them, there's only so much power that you have to do that. There's only one person, one thing that we have some power over to change, and that is ourselves. There you can make a difference, right? You can really make something, you can actually do something with yourself. So instead of expending your energy on uncertain things, right, the project of changing the world, it is very uncertain, very difficult. Expend the energy on where you know that the returns will be very good. Change yourself. And of course, when you change yourself, it doesn't just affect you. It's not just an egotistical thing. Yeah, I'm going to become good and happy. It affects other people as well. If you change yourself and people see that you're becoming more kind, you're becoming more generous, you're becoming more wise, it will affect a large number of people around you. There's a ripple effect, right? It spreads out. Somebody else gets touched by that, and then they spread it out to other people, and it spreads out into a large part of society here. And this is what you find, like one person like Ajahn Brahm, you know, you find that some of his talks on YouTube are downloaded by hundreds of thousands of people, quite literally here. And of course, when that happens, the message gets out to a very, very large number of people. And the reason why people listen to him is because of his personal qualities. People have this sense that there are qualities there that are very good. So they respect him for those qualities, then they listen. But first of all, he had to change himself, right? First of all, he had to become that person who people actually respect. You don't gain respect out of nothing. You have to earn that respect. And he has earned that through being a monk for over 40 years or whatever, doing the right thing, practicing in the right way, having a high degree of integrity, etc. So it works. So instead of trying to change the world too much, change yourself. Now, part and parcel of changing yourself, part and parcel of that is being kind to others. Right? So these things, this is not one-sided. Changing yourself is a completely introverted, narcissistic thing. Only think about yourself. No, it is actually, part of that is actually helping other people. And when you help other people, you don't do it in a greedy, selfish way. You do it selflessly. And then you're actually developing yourself. So there are two sides of the same coin. So don't have too high ambitions about changing the whole world. Rather just apply that kindness to the people around you, to the people that you meet in your life. And that, I think, already is one of the best ways of changing everything and changing everybody. Because it has these beautiful, wonderful ripple effects that go out. Of course, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do things like, if you want to help with poverty and you want to, help with, counteract whatever inequality and injustice there is in the world, do that. But be careful not to get too caught up in those things, that you lose your moral compass and you get angry and upset and all this kind of stuff. If you do that, you may find it's detrimental to yourself. And if it's detrimental to your own practice, then I think you have to think twice on how you're dealing with those things. Okay, so that is all for this morning. So I will see you again for a last session at, I think it's 1:30 this afternoon. And in the meantime, have a nice lunch, and I'll see you at 1:30.